It is Friday, May the 19th. This is VOA's International Edition. Many thanks for joining us. Coming up, President Trump contends a special investigation into his team's connection with Russia is dividing the nation.
I think it's extremely disappointing that that is the president's view of Mr. Mueller and his role. Mr. Mueller is clearly a man of integrity. He led our country in his role with the FBI after 9/11 and the Katrina disaster. He's uniformly respected.
Also ahead, the U.S.-led airstrike against pro-Assad forces in Syria, plight of Somali children, we'll have a social media update, and a famed L.A. theater turning 90. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. President Trump on Thursday said the appointment of a special counsel for the ongoing investigation into his campaign's ties to Russia is appropriate, but it can divide the country. He was reacting to the appointment of former FBI Director Robert Mueller to lead the investigation after Mr. Trump fired FBI Director James Comey.
Well, I respect the move, but the entire thing has been a witch hunt, and there is no collusion between certainly myself and my campaign, but I can always speak for myself and the Russians, zero. I think it divides the country. I think we have a very divided country because of that and many other things. So I can tell you that we want to bring this great country of ours together.
President Trump speaking at a joint news conference with Colombia's President Juan Manuel Santos here in Washington. The appointment of former FBI Director Mueller as special counsel has sparked a lot of discussion among political types as well as pundits. One subject that comes up frequently is what is the difference between a special counsel and a special prosecutor, which has been the title of persons in previous cases involving the White House, where there were implications of criminal wrongdoing rather than just unethical behavior. International Edition's Lori London speaks with former prosecutor Laurel Brandstetter, who currently is a white-collar criminal defense attorney with the firm Schneider, Harrison, Siegel, and Lewis.
Special counsel is a lawyer, and there's someone that's going to be appointed in this case by the attorney general when there is what we call a conflict of interest for somebody that would normally conduct the investigation. So it can come up when an investigating agency itself is under scrutiny, for example, or a particular prosecutor is under scrutiny, and so it has to go to another office. And in this instance, we have the Department of Justice, you know, who has to now take a look at the actions of our president and others. So really, it's done to ensure integrity in government.
What powers does he have in this role?
He essentially has all the powers of a United States attorney. So he can convene grand juries. He can seek immunity. He can issue charges. He can have charges dismissed. So really, all of the powers and duties that a United States attorney would enjoy in prosecuting cases, he will enjoy as well, with less reporting up the chain of command, because he can't do that in this instance. He has to be independent from all of that. So we really need to think of him as a prosecutor in the traditional sense with all of those powers.
Would he be potentially allowed to subpoena and interview the President of the United States?
Absolutely.
What about issuing some sort of a request or a subpoena for the president's tax returns if he's determined that they could be helpful in the investigation?
If that inquiry, if the need to look at Mr. Trump's taxes stems directly from the scope of the investigation as he's been given it, then the quick answer and the short answer is yes. I suspect, however, that that might be a bit tangential to what I think he's looking at or will be looking at, and he would likely need to seek approval to expand the scope of the investigation.
There have been reports that the president's financial dealings, if there were any related to Russia, that they could potentially be linked to this whole investigation. So I think that's why maybe the concept of the tax returns was in question.
Well, and in that instance, you know, turning really to the obstruction statutes and the tampering statutes, those statutes talked about corrupt influence. So if the financial dealings of the president indicated transactions that corrupted him and then motivated him to either obstruct or impede an investigation, then you're absolutely correct. His financial dealings could become part of this whole story as it unfolds.
President Trump has called the entire thing, including appointing this special prosecutor, a witch hunt and said that it will divide the country. Do you have any comment on that?
I think it's extremely disappointing that that is the president's view of Mr. Mueller and his role. Mr. Mueller is clearly a man of integrity. He led our country in his role with the FBI after 9/11 and the Katrina disaster. He's uniformly respected. And the public wants answers regardless of what side of the aisle you hail from. So to turn that on its head and say to the American people that this is nothing but a witch hunt, I think is shameful and disrespectful to the process. And I think it's unfortunate. If there's really nothing there, then he's got nothing to hide, and he should welcome someone of Mr. Mueller's caliber with open arms and welcome the inquiry.
Could it be possible that this inquiry could lead to other things that we don't even know about?
Absolutely. I did these sorts of, on a much smaller scale, investigations, and they're exactly that. They're an investigation. It's an inquiry, and you follow the evidence where it leads you, and sometimes it leads you in a direction that you thought you were going. Sometimes you hit a dead end, and an investigation needs to be closed, and other times there's tangential investigations that you had no idea that you would be pursuing when you started it. So I think that's certainly possible.
And lastly, I would just ask, could President Trump fire Mr. Mueller? Does he have does the president have the authority to do that?
Well, the short answer is yes, but the federal regulations sort of provide for the removal and the termination, and they talk about dereliction of duty, violation of Department of Justice policy or procedures as grounds for removing a special counsel. And so he could do it. It would look absolutely terrible. And I am quite sure that Mr. Mueller understands DOJ policies and his duty really to the country at this point. So I would be shocked if there were any missteps on his part. But the short answer is Mr. Trump could have him removed.
Do you expect this investigation to last a long time?
I do. I think we're looking at least 6 months and then maybe much longer, depending on where this leads.
And will the public sort of be out of the loop from now on? Because up until now, this has been an ongoing daily TV drama playing out for the American people.
I think that's a very real possibility. And I think that we all need to prepare for a period of radio silence once Mr. Mueller starts his work. The integrity of the investigation will depend on confidentiality and that he be free to pursue leads and do the work of the investigation without reporting information out publicly. That level of public reporting and involving the public in an investigation can really paint the scope, the pace, and the integrity of the investigation. So I suspect that he will keep things very quiet as soon as he has his staff in place and has his marching orders.
That is Laurel Brandstetter, a former prosecutor who currently is a white-collar criminal defense attorney with the firm Schneider, Harrison, Siegel, and Lewis. She was speaking with my colleague, Lori London. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. You can listen to Encounter on Saturdays and Sundays. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on the Voice of America.
Savor the flavor of African music. I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. A U.S.-led coalition aircraft has struck pro-Syrian government forces that continue to violate a deconfliction zone, which is set up around an army base where special forces are training Syrian militia. For more on this story, my colleague Sarah Williams speaks with Carla Babb, the VOA correspondent covering the U.S. military.
Well, according to a U.S. defense official, these pro-Syrian government forces were in an established deconfliction zone. I was talking to Major Josh Shakes. He's a spokesman for U.S. Central Command. They are the ones who are conducting operations inside the Middle East. And Major Jakes told me that they came within this 55-kilometer radius around Ataf Base. Now, Ataf Base is where the U.S. is training hundreds of Syrians, a couple hundred Syrian forces. And so when these Syrian regime forces came in near the rebels and near the U.S.-led coalition people, they did everything they could to try to get them to leave the area. They did shows of force, that is kind of flying in aircraft. So you can hear the aircraft. They know that you're being seen. They can see you. That did not turn the group around. They also then fired missiles into the ground near them. That did not make them turn around as well. They continued to push towards and establish defensive areas in that little zone that has been established as deconfliction zones. And then after all of that failed, they even called the Russians. They called the Russians to try to get the Syrians out that way. The Russians had, according to one official, had been trying to get up with them, and it's unclear why they continued not to move, but there was basically no other choice left for the U.S.-led coalition and the Syrian rebels. They had to strike them because they were clearly a threat.
Now, this is in an area where Syria, Jordan, and Iraq intersect?
It's very near there. So there's a border crossing not too far away from this base. But this base is where U.S. officials have been training Syrian forces to fight the Islamic State. Now, the Syrian regime forces have also said that they are fighting Islamic State, and this area had been an area of tensions, rising tensions, because they're getting closer and closer and closer. But the key here is that the U.S. and the Russians had continued to be using this deconfliction line. So whenever the Russians needed to conduct airstrikes in the area, they would call the U.S. on the deconfliction line, and they would say, hey, we are doing this, and it was no problem. In fact, Major Jake said that the Russians had used that deconfliction line within the past 24 hours. This was not a big deal. What is a big deal is when the Syrians came in, they came in with tanks. They came in with armored vehicles, artillery vehicles, technical vehicles, and they were using bulldozers to build a fighting position for these tanks. So that is clearly not a good thing. It was the implication that they were going to attack the base that the U.S. forces were at. So after all the warning fires, all of the shows of force, the U.S. coalition did strike a tank and it looks like two of the bulldozers as well. And the U.S. is calling for the Syrians to leave. What's crazy about the situation is it's still ongoing. There are still some of those Syrians in that deconfliction zone. Not everyone has left yet.
That is VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb speaking with International Edition's Sarah Williams. Also in the news, new research is showing that Somalia's drought is having serious consequences for more than 1 million children. The relief group Save the Children says they are at risk of increased violence, as well as child labor and of being separated from their families. The group's new study has found that the impact of the drought has gone far beyond life-threatening shortages of essentials such as food and water. It's also causing high levels of psychological distress in the children, who are showing unusual symptoms such as bouts of crying as well as screaming. Violence against children is also on the rise, including sexual violence such as rape and molestation. Devendra Tok is the global media manager for Save the Children in Hargeisa, Somaliland. He speaks now with VOA's Kim Lewis about the plight of the children of Somalia.
During emergencies such as drought here in Somalia, children are always the most vulnerable, and children face many problems. One of them is child protection. We know that children during such situations, particularly when families are getting separated and families are migrating and children have to move with their parents to new places, they have to meet with new people and get accustomed to being in a new place and also in strange circumstances. They also have no school to go to. All these conditions make the situation of children very perilous. The first issue, of course, is that children are with strangers and therefore they are much more vulnerable to abuse. And of course, when you have a drought situation which compels families into deeper levels of poverty, then there are issues like child labor which come into the picture because families need anything and everything to get along with their lives.
Can you give us an example of some of the experiences that children in Somalia are facing because of the drought situation?
We were visiting a few communities, in particular We met with a family living just by the main highway from Hargeisa when you're going towards the western side, where there are more greener areas apparently. And they've been there for 4 months. And one issue that was pointed out was that children absolutely hate living there. For example, children are scared of the hyenas because these families are camping out in temporary shelters out in the open. And they can hear the hyenas crying at night and even approaching their homes. So children are terrified of these situations. There's been a bit of rain recently. Suddenly it gets very cold in those regions. These families there don't have adequate shelter. They don't even have any kind of sheets to sleep on. And even their clothes are running out. So these children feel very cold and they are wet. So children are really, really under a lot of stress. Moreover, when they see their parents also being stressed out, it really complicates matters for children because they just don't know whom to turn to. And the other issue, of course, for them is that they are not going to school. As we know, that final exams for children are coming up in July this year. And many schools are either not open or children have moved so far away from their schools and are in such a situation that sometimes their parents can't even pay a paltry amount which is required to pay for the secondary education here.
Also, you had mentioned that they are at risk of sexual violence such as rape and molestation, and this is due to them being separated from their families. So what kind of treatment is there available for them, especially regarding the psychological trauma of this?
Yes, of course, psychosocial support is very important. Creating awareness among communities is what we do very well. So therefore, we have integrated much of our education work also into our other programs. Because with the schools closed, we are ensuring that, you know, we are able to quickly set up even child-friendly spaces. These child-friendly spaces have a trained person to provide them with recreational and educational opportunities and basically become a hub where children can be with other children and also feel more secure. You know, it's not very easy to come by figures about whether a child is raped or whether a child is missing. But therefore, through dissemination with communities, working at the community level with the communities, particularly now in the drought, we would intensify working with the community to ensure that the community is aware of the risks towards children and how to be able to, you know, overcome them, which includes simple things like, you know, taking care of health and hygiene.
Devendra Tak is the global media manager for Save the Children in Hargeisa, Somaliland. He was speaking with Kim Lewis, who is host of the VOA program Africa News Tonight. It is time now to see what's trending on social media with International Edition's Andrew Palchewski.
Today we'll look at three countries that are using social media in very different ways. And we'll start with Iran, where Iranians are using social media to bypass state-run media ahead of their presidential election. And it just so happens that two of the Iranians that are using apps like Instagram and Telegram are two of the top presidential candidates, President Hassan Rouhani and his opponent Ebrahim Raisi. They're broadcasting rallies on Instagram and are reaching supporters through messaging apps like Telegram. It's a huge step forward for Iran, and some hope it may signal a loosening of restrictions on social media going forward. Next, we head to Ukraine, where the government there announced a ban on the social network VK, also known as the Russian Facebook, because of cybersecurity fears and also sanctions on Russia. It was one of actually several websites that the Ukrainian government tried to block. Now, I say try because here's what VK did. They sent instructions to their Ukrainian users on how to get around the ban. In fact, this is what VK had to say. Quote, "We love our Ukrainian users and want you to be able to remain in touch with your friends and close acquaintances always." Now, this is bad news for the Ukrainian government. However, it's good news for VK, Russia, and anti-censorship advocates who had decried Ukraine's move to block these sites. And finally, we head to Thailand, where there was a Facebook face-off earlier this week. In Thailand, it's illegal to disparage or embarrass the country's king. So when a Facebook video appeared showing the king in a yellow crop top at a German mall, the Thai government gave Facebook an ultimatum. Remove this and other pieces of objectionable content, or we're blocking you. Facebook said they would remove any illegal content, but anything other than that, Thailand would have to get a court order in order for Facebook to remove it. Now, the deadline was on Tuesday. It came and went. And even though Facebook didn't remove all of the objectionable content, the site is still accessible in the country, at least for now. It's going to be interesting going forward to see what exactly happens when these cases come up like this. If the Thai government will sue Facebook, if Facebook will refuse to comply, and if the site actually does get banned in the country.
International Edition's Andrew Palchevsky. You can follow Andrew on Twitter at APAL. I'm on Twitter as well at VOA Norman, and our program, International Edition, can be found at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
Opening a restaurant's a lot of work, but not if you've got the Taste Please app. The new social dining app allows you to create a dining event, one that includes the location, number of guests, what's on the menu, and your price. You play the chef, and you make the money while meeting new people. Host Morgan Thomas says, think about it this way in terms of Airbnb. 10 years ago, would you have given the keys to your house to a total stranger from the other side of the world?
You wouldn't. Shared economy is like smashed through so many barriers. And this Taste Please social dining platform is really, this is the perfect time for kind of like entertaining new people.
Guest Julie Markison likes meeting new people and trying new things.
I just enjoy it because we can sit and talk like, how did you do this? How did you make this courses? Like, I love it.
The company was founded by Danish chef Frank Lance, who came up with the Taste Please idea at, well, a dinner party. From VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us on this Friday. You know, one of the most glamorous and long-lasting venues from Hollywood's golden age is Grauman's Chinese Theater in Los Angeles, and it is now celebrating its 90th birthday. VOA's David Byrd tells us there's a lot more at this movie palace than just stars' footprints in the cement.
One of the indications of success in Hollywood is to be invited to impress your handprint in the cement of Sid Grauman's Chinese Theater.
Sid Grauman opened what is now known as the TCL Chinese Theater on May 18, 1927. That was 2 years before the first Academy Awards were handed out. Through the decades, a galaxy of Hollywood stars have appeared on its screen and in the cement in front of the building. King Kong premiered there. So did The Wizard of Oz in 1939. George Lucas brought R2-D2 and C-3PO along for the premiere of Star Wars in 1977. Purple Rain had its premiere there, as did Titanic and Avatar. Levi Tinker is the current general manager of the Movie Palace.
It is actually the only single-screen theater in the country to be open 9 decades, completely as a first-run movie theater from the time it opened its doors through today, and continuously showing first-run movies on a daily basis.
The theater looks like a Chinese temple with marble carvings, a pagoda-shaped roof, and two huge Heaven's Dogs sculptures out front. Levi Tinker says Sid Grauman wanted to give audiences an escape, a place to get away from the real world and submerge themselves in the fantasies of the movies.
So he spared no expense in getting the best artists, best designers, and even importing elements from China. He had to get permission from the Chinese government and U.S. government to bring over the two Heaven's Dogs out in front of the theater in our courtyard. The artwork in the main lobby area was hand-painted back in 1927 by Ki Luke, who was a painter but also an actor as well, too.
You know them well, of course. Marilyn Monroe and Jane Russell. Here they are at Grauman's Chinese Theater in Hollywood to sign their names and print their hands and feet in concrete.
The theater is also known for its forecourt, where the glittering stars of Hollywood have left their hand and foot and hoof and leg and hair, in some cases, prints. The tradition started when silent film star Norma Talmadge was walking through the court and stepped in wet cement. Sid Grauman saw it and thought it was a great promotional gimmick. Grauman's has also been the site of innovation through the decades with early attempts at widescreen projection, the first 70mm films, the first CinemaScope, and the first digital projection. The theater is also the site of the premiere of the Ridley Scott-directed space thriller Alien Covenant. Scott says that the Chinese theater is a true treasure.
It's the history. You know, Hollywood is, whichever way you look at it, think about it, it's, you know, the most important place for movies in the world. That's it.
Actor Michael Fassbender agrees.
Yeah, I mean, in general, sort of Hollywood and this whole area is, it's got the history. It's, I mean, it's sort of the beginning of film.
The city of Los Angeles has designated the theater as a historic cultural monument, and the auditorium underwent the largest renovation in its history 4 years ago to make room for stadium seating and an IMAX screen. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
You know, I was once at Grauman's. I'm looking at the footprints there of Mercedes McCambridge. She was one of the stars of my favorite movie, Giant. And who to my left do I see but Elizabeth Taylor and one of her grandchildren? She was also in Giant. It was an amazing moment. Well, moving on to some sad news, it's the death of rock musician Chris Cornell. His distinctive voice led the bands of Soundgarden and Audioslave. It has been ruled, his death, that is, a suicide. Medical authorities in the U.S. city of Detroit, Michigan, say the 52-year-old Cornell hanged himself in his hotel room. Soundgarden was a major force in the 1990s musical movement known as grunge, along with groups such as Nirvana and Pearl Jam. One of Chris Cornell's most popular songs was Black Hole Sun. In my eyes, indisposed, in disguises no one knows, has the face, lies the snake, in the sun, in my disgrace, boiling heat, summer stench, neath the black, the sky looks dead, come on. Cornell and his wife Vicky launched a foundation, we understand, aimed at helping children facing homelessness, poverty, abuse, and neglect. And many of his contemporaries reacted to his death with shock and surprise. Thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Good to have you with us. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Greg Burns, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a great Friday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Defense Secretary Jim Mattis recently attended a defense ministerial in Denmark with members of the Global Coalition Against ISIS to discuss how to defeat the group. In a press conference following the meeting, Secretary Mattis said, "We're going to further accelerate this fight and to free the people currently suffering from Daesh's crushing occupation and our enemy's terror threat to Europe and beyond." Denmark's defense minister, Claus Hjort Frederiksen, described the effort to defeat ISIS as one of Denmark's highest priorities and agreed to substantially increase the country's defense budget to aid in the counter-ISIS campaign. ISIS has lost well over half its territory in Iraq and in Syria. In Afghanistan, the enemy has lost about two-thirds of its strength. Moreover, Afghan President Ashraf Ghani recently announced the death of Sheikh Abdul Hasib, the emir of ISIS Khorasan, an affiliate of ISIS in Afghanistan. "In our anti-ISIS campaign," said Secretary Mattis, "we are dealing that group one more significant blow with the loss of their leader." Secretary Mattis cautioned that the battlefield against ISIS is also a humanitarian issue, where innocent people live right now, sometimes forced to stay on the battlefield by ISIS. "We're going to do everything humanly possible to limit the suffering and any casualties among those innocent people," he said. "Once the ISIS threat is subdued," said Secretary Mattis, "the real work of rebuilding begins in order to prevent another terrorist group from filling the void." And how do we do that? "Bottom line is we've got to restore government services, and that means we all have to work together." "ISIS has done horrible damage," said Secretary Mattis. "That's why the U.S. is committed to working with its allies to defeat ISIS wherever it attempts to establish its roots."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA.
You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.